Hello, can you hear me at the back? That's good. I'm not blessed with a nice voice that carries, unfortunately, like a wonderful speaker just preceded me. My talk is going to overlap a lot of the things that Britt has already said, but it will be a focus both on the physical and the digital collections, and also on with a regional, from a European perspective, and an international perspective. As was said in the introduction, I'm from Leiden in the Netherlands, and I work for OCLC there, but I work increasingly more with my colleagues over here in North America. I wanted to start off with exactly in the same way that Britt started. So, looking at the challenges, what are the challenges? What are the responses to these challenges and problems? Are they the responses in themselves? Are they adequate? And is the whole lot together, is the ensemble actually cohesive? So what are the main challenges that we do lose valuable things? We lose them from natural disaster, deterioration, war, lack of care or will. To give you some examples, there was a major fire in 20th Century Fox in 1937, destroyed an enormous number of films. In particular, because of fire and because of lack of will, only 20% of silent films remain today. And an awful figure for Thay Dabara, only 3.5 of her films survived out of 40 films. The middle picture is more personal. That is a picture of the Cascade Brewery in Hobart, Tasmania. That had a major fire in 1966, and that destroyed their archives. That's a personal tragedy for me because my great-grandfather was one of the first brewers there, and we don't know who he was. They were supposed to have employed a lot of convicts, and we think that he might have been a convict, but he had such a common name, we can't work out that out. So that is, we lose terrible things. And we also lose digital things. So this is an example. If we break the links, then we've lost things that are digital. And the Rosetta Stone is a good example. That was found in 1799. It wasn't deciphered until 1814. And up until that time, everything, all the hieroglyphics. See, English people can't say their own words. they couldn't have been interpreted. More recently, this is a picture of the Bosnian National Library that was burning in August 1992. And I read on the website this rather heart-rendering phrase: when scores of books packed into shelves or in piles are set ablaze, the pages fuse and carbonize, turning into clinkers in the intense heat due to the lack of oxygen. So you think that they would just burn around the edges, but that's not the case. And that's not the only example. We have dreadful statistics from Cambodia, where all their libraries were destroyed, almost all of them. So looking at the challenges, there's also, we lose these physical things, but also that which cannot be found is lost. So an increasing part of the library's collection is now outside the library building. It is not well described, and it's not capable of some kind of virtual browse, then it's virtually lost. We have the example already of broken digital links, and there's also within our digital environment, there's a problem of obscurity. If you don't rank on the first few pages of the search engine, then you're lost. You never get found. And also, that which is not regularly accessed may get lost. And this is another particular problem in the digital world. So, for example, you have PDFs that won't open, not because the PDF format is wrong, but because within them they contain a font that simply is out of date and can't be interpreted. And the openers may get lost, the programs that interpret the data, the whole infrastructure. So, and I was interested about the CERN figures of every 4 years, you need to look at your infrastructure and make sure that everything that you've got can be still interpreted or opened. And another problem, moving on to the physical collection, is that people are weeding their collection in ignorance of what others are also doing. So you could have a situation where you have an enormous number of copies and everyone weeds them, and all of a sudden the book becomes quite rare. So looking at the challenges continued, there's limited space in the library buildings, and yet our physical collections are still continuing to grow. We have statistics from the British Library saying that they are growing by 12 kilometres a year, which is quite a staggering figure. And there's this wonderful quotation from Robert Darton in the New York Review of Books. In 2006, there were just short of 300,000 new titles were published in the US, and the number of new books has increased nearly every year for the last decade, despite the spread of electronic publishing. So the physical collection is still there and it's growing. And we also have at the same time an increase in grade material. My RLG colleagues encouraged me to leave Gray spelled that way. we have the problem that there's so much more self-publishing, there's very little peer review when things are self-published. There's resulting in increase of material of dubious merit, and it's difficult to detect the stuff that is of merit. And that leads to the question, how much of all of this should we be preserving? And that's a nice little picture there of junk. And Michael Gorman, I didn't have room to put his quotation here, but I'll read it to you, refers to our inability to differentiate easily between the substantial minority of digital resources that are of enduring value and the majority of digital documents that are of local, transient, or no value at all. So this brings me to talking about the preservation level, and because Fleur is not here, I'm very well happy to welcome a bit of the Netherlands here anyhow. These are pictures from Leiden. And on the right, at the top right, we have a picture of one of the national monument buildings that exist in Leiden. This is a very significant building. It's the Rhineland-Gemeinschaft. It's the oldest cooperative in the world, they claim to be. And they're still working from the same building, at least the facade of the building, as the cooperative that formed to drain the polders and actually make the land usable. And it's a wonderful building. And on the bottom, we have a streetscape in Leiden, where none of those buildings in particular of particular importance, but within the streetscape, they're of essential importance, and you wouldn't want to lose any one of those. And And that's the way we should be looking at our collections as well. And I'll just give you another picture from Leiden. This is another one of our gems. And there's, we don't only have two in Leiden. And that's the Ship's Carpenter's Building, which is one of my favourites. So those are the challenges that, I've defined, and the responses that we seem to be doing at the moment are making collective physical stores, because our buildings can't hold the growing collections, and we want to weed and weed collectively. We also are looking at digitization as a form of preservation. So had my great-grandfather's archives been digitized, at least we would have some of them when the fire occurred, because we're going to have disasters, floods, fires. We're also making collective digital stores and going beyond simple storage to true preservation, as was very aptly explained in the previous presentation. And also, exposure is a form of preservation. It's a form of making sure people find things, and it's a form of making sure that they're used and reused and retested simply by use. Some examples of collective physical stores in Europe, I'm not going to read them all, but they fall into three types. There are independent stores that are made, and these were actually tried in Germany, and for reasons I don't understand at all, because they have the most wonderful national interlibrary loan system, the independent national stores didn't work, but they did manage to get it to work by nominating one library in a region to become the physical store. And then over in England, they're making a central distributed hybrid in the form of the UK Research Reserve Project, and that's based on the British Library as physical store, and then having extra copies, up to 2, 3, or 4, held in nominated libraries around the region. Are physical stores adequate? Are they the correct response? They are if they have union catalogues that are reliable, that describe what's inside them. And the union catalogues are needed for both collection management and for exposure. It's interesting, the Finnish central store actually receives uncatalogued materials and then catalogues it, so that was interesting. And the UK Research Reserve has identified the unreliability of the serial holdings metadata as one of their main problems. And in particular, not only is the actual coverage of the library's holdings incomplete, but there's no indication of their retention policy. So we're back to that weeding problem before. What if everyone weeded at once and then we had nothing? They also rely on effective delivery systems and digitization on demand. And for digitization on demand, we need copyright evidence, and we're only just starting to make inroads there. And although we have varying systems for interlibrary loans, once you cross national borders, the architecture is very flimsy and incomplete. My colleagues at RLG said to me that in the US, many of the physical stores have been conceived for storage but not at all for delivery, and they're not even integrated into the nation's ILL infrastructure. And that's a problem. Looking at digitization, everybody is saying at the moment that we can't digitize everything in the foreseeable future, and we get different statistics depending on how they're counted, as is always the case. CNN ENL in 2007 estimated that only 1% of what's around can be digitized. And in 2005, OCLC looked at the Google Book program, Google Print as it was then, and estimated that its 10-year plan was only going to cover 35% of what was in WorldCat. And Kathy Zielowski she's an Australian author, has estimated that we are looking at getting to be covering about 12%. There's also a lot of people have remarked that we've been digitizing for indexing, particularly Google Books, without preservation at all in mind, and that this means that we will need to go and re-digitize quite a lot of what's already been done. And then, of course, from the French perspective and the European perspective, the initial reaction to Google Books was very strong. Jean-Noël Jeannonet, who was the head of the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, he criticised on four main points. Firstly, he pulled out many examples of cultural bias. So main French texts would come up in translated version first. He's worried about the commercial bias. There's plenty of examples of badly digitized pages. Then there are access reuse restrictions, and also that Google makes no guarantees about preservation. And this is where the next presentation comes in, because this has sparked a lot of European activity, and particularly in relation to Europeana, which my virtual colleague is going to tell you about. Now, this is Beat's new boss, she tells me. this is the head of the Royal Library in Denmark, and I think he's a reincarnation of Winston Churchill. He's wonderful. I wanted to just actually quote him for the whole presentation, but I limited myself to two. He says, "Too many, often small institutions or institutions with relevant collections of too modest a volume want to digitize too little at too high a price without being able to justify distributed costs of investment and management." And I just I will also want to refer in the notes to the RLG program's examination of the comparison of the various contracts that people have been making with search engines for doing their digitization. Moving on to talking about digitization and copyright, because it's such an important topic. OCLC is now making a registry of copyright evidence. This is an international registry. A lot of it is, the idea is that once somebody has gone through all the due diligence to work out if something is or it is not covered by copyright, then that should be available to everyone, and it shouldn't be work that's repeated. And on the note of copyright, my newly found inspiring friend, dying to meet one day, the extension of copyright limit in Europe from 50 to 70 years was simply a catastrophe and an enormous obstacle to developing a relevant, adequate and comprehensive European digital library with 20th century material of significant importance. The legal demands of investigating and finding the heirs, the due diligence, is prohibitive. Moving on to centralized and collective digital stores. We have many examples of these in Europe. I won't go into them all. We also have Clocsys, which I'll be talking about later, and web archiving. Okay. The European Library will also be covered later. So far the EU has been funding merely the infrastructure for the European Digital Library. Now it's warming to actually giving funds for digitization itself, but it still needs serious funding. And there's another quotation there from Mr. Nielsen. Nothing wrong with the vision, but it's financially unrealistic. And Astrid Huizen from the Royal Library in the Netherlands calls for a better balance between quality, quantity and costs. And she's more or less saying that we should be going for quantity. We should stop spending all this time on selection and do things in bulk. We also are looking at archiving license and research content, which may not actually be part of the library collection, but may be part of an individual library, but may be part of a wider part of the national and international culture. And there we have in the cross the UK and the US, we have CLOCSIS. And there's also a lot of attention being paid within the European Union in the seventh framework to trying to work out how to preserve the research data. And CLOCSIS is an implementation of the system LOCSIS, which is an acronym for lots of copies, keep stuff safe. And they have on their webpage this wonderful quotation from Thomas Jefferson. Somebody said to me, I'm very glad he thought of making that quotation for us in the future. Let us save what remains, not by vaults and locks which fence them from the public eye and use in consigning them to the waste of time, but by such a multiplication of copies as shall place them beyond the reach of accident. So that is CLOCSIS. Very much, the UK is a very important partner in that. In long-term archiving solutions, we have quite a lot of activity in Europe. From the Dutch National Library, we have the e-depot system, COPAL from the Deutsche National Bibliothek, LOCSIS, which is the system behind CLOCSIS, and Portico, which is the JSTOR one. Now moving on to web archiving, this is a new standard that's going through its final voting stages in ISO. The project's been led by the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, and it's a standard that attempts to, I'm not going to read this whole slide, it attempts to define the metadata that's going to be needed to make sure that something can be opened in the future. Implementations of the work. We have the Bibliothèque Nationale de France. It's just releasing this week. A webpage, it's in beta test, and it's got 120 terabytes of data and 10 billion files. So they're taking web archiving very seriously. The scope of their web archiving is very interesting as well. They don't just try to preserve everything in the .fr domain. They try to get everything French or everything that would be commonly viewed by the French in their web searching experience. And there are similar examples in Norway and Sweden of them doing this level of archiving, but they're limiting themselves to their national domains. The work format came from the International Internet Preservation Consortium, and there's a list of countries there that are part of that consortium. And I just want to echo what Beard said earlier, and that is to contrast the way that this is being done in Europe and other countries like Australia with the US, where there is no national library, and it isn't the responsibility of any one particular organisation. And so then there is overlapping projects and without full coverage as a result. So we have to envy the French and their partners. Now, I want to move on to finish with to exposure as a very important part of preservation. And in terms of Werner Schwarz, visibility in a way can be seen to be indispensable in the survival of the item. And exposure needs to be increasingly international, because the users are expecting to find things in the international search engines. So this brings out the importance of having a good web presence. So libraries are now faced from exposure with a double challenge. They need to act on two fronts. They need to make sure that they can be found externally, and they need to be enriching the metadata that they're storing at home. The reality is that we've still got big, big challenges in this area. Cataloging backlogs are still real. And this photograph is the University of Warsaw, which I was there in January. They have a huge number of their collection is not catalogued, or if it is catalogued, it's sitting in those drawers. And it's interesting, nobody's opening the drawers, they're all looking at the timers. The Bavarian State Library only just finished their cataloguing backlog in 2004. And as Michael Gorman warns, millions of digital documents and resources are uncatalogued and even unmapped and difficult to retrieve. At the same time as we've got these cataloguing backlogs, the catalogues themselves are becoming richer, and they're trying to emulate the browsing experience that gets removed when you don't have a physical collection in front of you. They are supporting selection, learning from the online shopping experience, and they're accepting user contributions, which are becoming increasingly more important. And that one way to make the catalogues richer is to do a lot more research into data mining, so that instead of data crafting, we do data mining. And this can result in particularly rich data. I'll just give you some very quick idea. This is WorldCat Identities. I don't know if anybody's seen this. It's available free on the web. You can get to it from WorldCat.org. So this is an attempt to make an author view of the catalogue. So we have made an analysis of the timeline of his publications of this author, with most widely held works and the most widely held works about the author, what the audience level is, various bits of cover art, and all the related identities. And then links into the virtual international authority file. So that's an example of data mining being able to produce rich data. Other examples of very rich metadata come from reading lists. In Norway, Estonia, and Denmark, they have reading lists that are made on their sites, and also in the form of statistics. So very, very valuable circulation information is being fed into the National Union catalogues in Denmark and in Slovenia. So they actually know the circulation history of all their volumes in their countries. Envy, envy. there are lots of National Union catalogues. These are some examples of the National Union catalogues that have public exposure. Now, I wanted to give you an example. We are really making some inroads with exposure. This is a book that's in the National Library in the Netherlands. It can be found from the National Union catalogue and from the TEL catalogue and from WorldCat and from Google Books. And it's in Google Books because the publisher let the Google have the digitized copy. And that digitized copy, Google will only show snippets of, and then either direct the user to get it from WorldCat and then eventually down, and or to buy it. I've got a whole lot of statistics here on WorldCat and how it's becoming a very wonderful vehicle for exposure, but I won't go into them. This is just a very interesting slide, however. These are the statistics on the number of records that are coming in a month, a number of hits coming in a month. And originally, they were all coming from the search engines, which is the blue box, the blue slice. And now the red slice are coming in from all over the place, which means that people are discovering it all on their own, which is very, very encouraging. And we're getting many, many hits a month, a million referrals a month. So that brings me on to the difference between what is coming back to that slide of the global treasures and the regional treasures. These are the global responsibilities and the regional responsibilities. Basically, at the global level, we need exposure. We need exposure of the collections and of the services. We need to manage the exposure data and curate the rare and priceless and make an electronic delivery architecture. Because if it's electronic, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't need to be national. At the regional and national level, we need to curate the collective collection, provide delivery services, and become part of a global physical delivery architecture. And that's a big hole at the moment. So, fundamental questions. Are our responses adequate? Are they adequate? In the physical stores, we need better metadata, better delivery, more copyright evidence. It's the right idea, but we need better buy-in. For digitization, we need more volume, quality, restrictions. We need copyright evidence. For collective digital stores, let's hope that our techniques will stand the test of time. And for exposure, perhaps it's here that we're learning the fastest. Does it make coherent sense? I'll leave you to say. Let me finish with this quotation from Robert Darnton, who's not a librarian. Electronic enterprises come and go. Research libraries last for centuries. Better to fortify them than to declare them obsolete, because obsolescence is built in the electronic media. Well, thank you very much.